The first case on calendar today is Good v. State, 52534. You'll note that Justice Perry-Gary and I are here in person. Justice Seda is in Carson City appearing by video. Sometimes there's a bit of a lag on the video, so it's easy for the lawyers and the justice to end up talking over one another. So try to work within that if you can. But are you, counsel, ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
Please do so.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm here today, Scott Eichhorn, on behalf of Appellant Amon Good. I'd like to briefly talk about why I believe this appellant, this young man, should prevail in his appeal. In this appeal, there are nine very substantive appellate issues. When I prepared this brief, it's prepared in a linear fashion, but I would like to emphasize some of the points more, or issues more, over others. And I hope it doesn't throw things off to take it a little bit out of order in that regard. The Nevada Constitution talks about, in Section 3, Article 1, and hopefully I've quoted that properly, talks about that the, among other things, that the right to jury trial shall remain inviolate forever. A very dramatic statement of how important the right to a jury trial is. And implied within that, certainly, and consistent with the U.S. Constitution as well, is that it would be a full and fair trial, you know, free of structural problems that interfere with that process being fair. Quite simply, the jury part component of our system is so fundamental and basic to it and makes it such a wonderful system. But here we have a problem that began early on in the case with the veneer. And what happened was basically that there was a probably a few days into the jury selection. It was very contested. We'd almost reached the point where we were close to having a jury. Over a lunch period, one of the co-defendants was talking loudly on his phone in the hallway, which also happened to be lined with veneer persons, and was talking about things such as obviously using profanity, talking about marijuana, how the case was not such a big deal, and why was the state making such a big deal about it. And jurors, potential jurors of veneer, brought it to the attention of the court, and it resulted in 16 of them being excused for cause because of the comments that they made, the impression that that conversation had made on them. And not only on them as to the defendant who actually made those statements, but to the other two co-defendants, including my client, the appellant, about how it gave a negative, very negative inference to them about how they're going to view the case right there at the front end, at the beginning of the case. When you have that taint at the beginning, that covers the whole rest of the case, you have a very basic problem with one of the more important parts of a criminal justice system with the jury. You have to have them clean going into that so that they're only making a decision on the evidence that's presented to them rather than some third part that's an interference. Whether you view that as jury tampering by a third party, whether it was intentional or unintentional, it happened. One thing that was very concerning is during that process where we were trying to sort out who heard this conversation, who didn't hear this conversation, one veneer person, a lady I remember this very specifically, commented that there were other people who were, at least if they didn't hear the conversation, were talking about it and heard it from other people who hadn't come forward and raised their hands during the process where they're trying to sort out these individuals. So it was a real question about who wasn't raising their hand and why and sorts of things. There was a taint there that was palpable. Now, Judge Vega's solution, because we're essentially out of a sufficient number of veneer, was to bring in a fresh cut of veneer persons, but also to keep what was left of what they were able to sort out. There's a separate canvas that was done of the new group. two were eventually put together, and that's where the jury came from. And our argument, and I believe it was of all three co-defendants, was that it was improper not to excuse an entire old veneer and bring in a new veneer, and it would have cured the problem, unquestionably cured the problem. But here, there always had to be a lingering question of who was left. You know, was there someone, for some reason, that wasn't raising their hand in defiance of the oath that requires them to be honest with their responses? And it was such an easy problem to solve by bringing in the new veneer, which was done partly, so it wasn't so much of an inconvenience that it couldn't have been done for the whole veneer, and then the problem would have been eradicated. But what was of great concern, the comments that we did get from the people that were responsive, was basically that this did affect how they viewed the defendant who said it, as well as the other parties as well. It was a negative inference. I think there was a reference to basically it sounded like a gangster language. I mean, it wasn't a positive remark that they were making. So that was, I think, by failing to do that, by failing to bring in an entirely new veneer, it was an abuse of discretion. It would have solved the problem. Instead, it potentially compounded the problem. And again, this is important because this is the jury trial system, a fair trial with that jury, who's only making a decision upon what's in front of them, the evidence that's presented to them. We try to keep them almost as sanitary as possible until we're presenting evidence to them. And here, we always have to have that question of,
But the district court did go on to inquire with each of these jurors, and don't you have a pretty significant standard to overcome looking at Weber?
Well, essentially, what I would view as abuse of discretion, standard of whether to, I think our motion was to grant a mistrial, or bring in a new veneer or grant a mistrial. It is quite a standard to go over. I think she was doing her best, obviously, to try to sort out what the problem was, but because we kept becoming aware with that first group that people who were commenting on it were not raising their hand and indicating these negative experiences, we just didn't know where the problem stopped. So that was an initial concern. But let me move on to the second part, and it also deals with the jury as well. Obviously, a decent and fine group of people. I'm not disparaging, the jury that we had in any way, but I think they made an honest effort to deal with a difficult case. But the resulting verdict, I think the only explanation for that, and the resulting verdict was, for my client, was essentially there were three counts, not guilty on the conspiracy count. There was attempt murder, use of deadly weapon, gang enhancement, and then a similar battery with similar enhancements. The verdict was for guilty on the assault or attempt murder, but no enhancements. But on the battery count, there was for the guilty for the battery as well as all the enhancements. Now, what's kind of peculiar and strange about this is, and this is something laid out in the opening brief, is that both those charges, with the exception of the scienter for attempt murder, the specific intent to kill, they read nearly identical. So obviously they're referring to the same conduct, that being the stabbing of Mr. Ciro Gil Corona, the alleged victim in the case. And with the way that the jury instructions are structured, a jury is directed, instructed to follow. Basically, you start with the most serious thing and work your way down. If you don't find this, then you move down to the lesser charge. If you don't find the enhancements, then you move along in this. Kind of like consider the serious thing first. So the jury following the instructions properly should have resulted at a verdict, perhaps on both, it's possible certainly, as to the attempt murder and the battery, but you would expect both the enhancements to also be guilty or not guilty, a consistent verdict.
But isn't that equally consistent with the jury exercising some lenity that is within the ambit of the their discretion?
Well, because I would presume that they were, I mean, we'll never know exactly. We're not really allowed to inquire in a way that can be presented to your court.
But I'm not proposing that we do that, but I'm just saying the argument is that that's a compromise verdict to make exhibits lenity, not
Yeah, obviously there was something going on back there where they were trying to accommodate some concern. We'll never know exactly what that concern was. Maybe it was a sentencing consideration, which would not be an appropriate consideration for them. But, I mean, the law calls us for to look at things that are objective and say, what can we say by looking at this objectively? Because it would be too hard to look into the crystal ball and basically say, well, what were they doing back there? I better get to the point here. But with this, when you look at that verdict, inconsistent between those, with the enhancements, something had to be going on in there that was not consistent with the instructions, which basically are, consider this, and then you can consider this, the identical factual situation between the two. If there was something different factual that they were considering, I would say, yeah, that, you know, they could possibly do that. But because of the inconsistency between the two, I think that there was something improper going on, inconsistent with the oath. Probably well-intentioned, but the instructions are meant to be followed. They take an oath to follow them, and when they don't do it, you get this kind of strange result. When they don't do that, I mean, it is prejudicial to the defendant. It resulted in some additional felony count. I don't know for sure that they would have gone one way or the other, but it also resulted in additional enhancements, a greater sentence, an additional prejudice in not being eligible for parole eligibility as easily maybe even a security classification that was higher. But it's
essentially speculative as to what was going on. I mean, if it were a civil case and you had inconsistency, the lawyer can say, hey, Judge, I want to ask the jury about this, and presumably you could have done that even morning. You don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth if that's... I'm not sure what we do with that.
The law says we have to look at just objectively at it. We can't even inquire. We can't ask for an affidavit of, hey, folks, what were you thinking? I mean, we talked with the folks, but I think
that's off the record. You're not on the record.
I'm actually prohibited from commenting on that.
But legally, that's why I think the law says you look at that, and it's probably, we excuse that as an act of grace or lenity rather than... Yeah.
With the case law, I think if it becomes clear that it's a sentencing consideration that they're trying to compromise, that it is considered inappropriate, even if that's what they were doing, because and the bottom line is they're not supposed to make sentencing considerations. That's up for the judge, and therefore it's misconduct, a compromise verdict. There's not a lot of case law to help us out, here in Nevada concerning that, and frankly, that's the first time that I've ever encountered, you know, something quite like that. To briefly touch on a few other things, since my time is quickly going away, and I'm afraid I would, you know, not be able to fill my time. There was a few evidentiary issues concerning admission of juvenile adjudications. We definitely have a real problem with that because, as you know, they are adjudications, not convictions. They are civil matters. They're not entitled to a jury trial. It's meant to be a formal, informal process. I apologize. Informal process. And in certain respects, it's even said this is a civil matter. They're adjudicated. They're committed rather than imprisoned. And to be able to use those in the context of, I mean, here the complaint is that it's used in the context of trying to prove up a gang enhanced. And believing that's inappropriate, it doesn't have the actual and legal certainty of conviction. Clearly, there are some things that would be punishable as a felony if my defendant was a juvenile at the time of this incident. But those things, the case or matter before us, can't be used as part of that to prove the like felony conduct for the gang enhancement. So
why can't if you've got felony criminal offenses, why can't the statute or the allowance for certification of juvenile offenders for prosecution as adults under 62B through 30 take us out of that civil context?
Well, it certainly can be done. That's certainly at the discretion of the state to do in the past cases that they were trying to use. And this is where the complaint is concerning those past cases that were the civil juvenile adjudications. If they were adults, you know, it would clearly be, you know, likely to be charged as felonies, but these are civil adjudications. My fear is treating, you know, civil adjudications in the same manner as that you treat criminal adult convictions or matters where they have been certified up creates a danger because there are certain procedural protections, the standard of proof is lower, and certain things are lacking in the civil adjudications, essentially, that you don't have with convictions once you make it to.
But the statute that allows for enhancement doesn't require a conviction for those matters punishable as felonies.
If I may proceed, it is interesting language, punishable as a felon.
Right.
The only thing I can draw an analogy to is there was another case dealing with whether a juvenile in a detention facility could be considered a prisoner, meaning are they treated as an adult when, you know, you have an escape or battery by prisoner situation. Now, this court ruled that they could not be treated. You know, obviously there was a distinction in the way that they were treated. Now, I think the state went to legislature and basically changed the law to subsequently allow that. And we can certainly do that here to, you know, clarify that civil adjudications in a juvenile situation, if punishable as a felony, should they, if they were an adult, could be used in this context, will certainly clarify that. But I think we have a little bit of a gray area there that's rather squishy because of where these things come from.
Actually, that's one of Justice Perrigo's words.
Okay. I hope that answered your question, Ron.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Sonia Jimenez with the District Attorney's Office in Clark County for the State of Nevada. Also present is my trial co-counsel, Mark Skipalakwa, also a Chief Deputy District Attorney with the Clark County District Attorney's Office.
Could you start where he left off?
That would be great. That's exactly where I would like to start. The game enhancement is sort of a unique beast here in the state of Nevada. It's not like the other enhancements that we have. And to be frank, we don't have a lot of case law that specifically discusses the gang enhancement, but we do have the language of the statute itself, as well as some cases, in particular Orojo Candido, which discusses the gang enhancement. With respect to the juvenile adjudications, the exact language from NRS 193.168 is that to be a criminal gang, the gang must has as one of its common activities engaging in criminal activity punishable as a felony. The punishable as a felony portion modifies the criminal activity. Clearly, the legislature is focusing on the conduct being felonious conduct as opposed to the age of the perpetrator. And that really makes sense because you don't need an expert to tell you that sadly most criminal gangs are made up of a large percentage of juveniles, and it's often the younger gang members who are the ones who are being required to engage in that felonious activity because they have to prove themselves to be members of the gang. It may be a requirement of entrance, and these are things that were testified to by Detective Sauber during the proceedings, during his testimony at trial.
And juveniles can in fact commit felonies and be punished under the statute as adults for felonies. It doesn't, you're saying there's no connection to age here. It's just the fact that something could be punishable as a felony.
Exactly. The focus is on the conduct of the members of the gang, not on the age of the people who are committing that conduct. And certainly, you may have juveniles who are certified either through the certification process. You may have juveniles who commit crimes that are direct file crimes that the juvenile court doesn't have jurisdiction on. And I think it would be somewhat arbitrary to have the status or the definition of a criminal gang hinge on whether or not a juvenile was adjudicated, was certified, was a direct file. The focus is on what kind of conduct are the individuals in the gang engaging in. So I don't think that there's anything in the statute or in case law that would support the fact that the state cannot present evidence of these juvenile adjudications. I'd also point out that when you're in the juvenile proceedings and there is a juvenile petition, it's the same criminal code, it's the same statutes that are used to proceed on those adjudications. Yes, they may technically be civil in nature, but the conduct itself is dictated by the criminal code, which is the same criminal code that's used in the adult system. So I think on that point, too, I think there is no basis, and logically it just wouldn't make sense to say that the state can only use gang activity that was committed by adults or that was punished by in adult court. That simply
and, in fact, they could have reworded the statute. It would have been an easier manner of expressing it to say felonious activity rather than punishable as.
Exactly. They exactly could have said that. And it also comes back, I think, to the point that was asked of my opposing counsel about whether or not there even have to be convictions, because the statute does not require convictions or adjudications. It doesn't use that language. I think, from my point of view as a prosecutor presenting the case, I think I always like to include conduct that, if not all of the conduct, at least some of the conduct resulted in adjudications or convictions, because I think that that's, as a weight matter, something that the jury wants to look into, but it's not that that is something that is required. In Orihel Candido, which is the case that talks specifically about prior felonious activity as it relates to the gang enhancement, they talked about the fact that they want more than just a conclusory statement that this activity is a common activity of the gang. But they don't focus on convictions, and they don't focus on adjudications. What they didn't like was the fact that the expert simply just testified, yes, the I think it was Maravilla gang meets the definition of a criminal gang with nothing more. There was much more evidence presented in this case. We didn't simply present the evidence about the adjudications, but we presented evidence about how common of an activity this felonious activity is in the gang. Detective Souter, who was the gang expert, testified, this is a small gang. We're not talking about 28th Street or 18th Street or some of the larger Blood or Crip sets. This was a relatively small gang here in Clark County. And clearly, gang enhancement doesn't just apply to larger gangs, because they only have a requirement that there be a minimum of three or more people who are part of this gang. And we had testimony from Detective Souter that the gang did grow in size, that at the time of the crime, there were approximately, well, let me start with the time of the trial testimony. At the time of the trial testimony, there were approximately 60 documented members and affiliates. Detective Souter then clarified that of those 60, approximately 30 of those were documented as primary members, meaning the rest are documented as either associating or as having another gang as their primary gang, and this is merely another affiliation of theirs. He then clarified that at the time that the crime committed was committed in 2009-2010, crime happened in 2010, but during 2009-2010, there were really only approximately 15 primary members, seven of whom had been identified as founding members. Detective Souter then went on to discuss the fact that of those 15 primary members, the majority of them had been involved in felonious activity, which was evidence of the common nature of that felonious activity. He also discussed the fact that, to his knowledge, there was no other main activity that was the gang was involved in. Of course, in Nevada, we don't have to show it's a primary activity, but it does go to the common nature of the activity. If it's not, you know, they're not a charitable organization, they don't have a formalized sports team, the activity that they're engaging in is a common activity, and there was a lot of additional detail other than just the examples of the felonious activity that were presented to document that information. Also, I would, if the court is interested, our gang enhancement is based off the gang enhancement in California. And California has quite a bit of case law which the court may consider persuasive in this instance because of the similarity. And if I may respectfully suggest to the court, there was a bench brief that was filed when this issue came up during trial by the state that we included in our respondent's appendix at page 73. And that brief does discuss and go into, it discusses Orihel Candido, but it also discusses some of the California case law. If the court wanted to look outside the jurisdiction and see what at least one other state has done that has a very similar statute. California does have some additional requirements that we don't have, but we tried to focus that in California, because they have clarified that, that you don't have to have convictions, although convictions are admissible. And they've clarified what some, they've had much less gang testimony than we've had in our case be affirmed by an appellate court. What's interesting about the gang enhancement is you kind of get objections along the broad spectrum. I've gotten objections saying that the state shouldn't be allowed to introduce any evidence of felonious activity, which clearly would prevent us from proving the case. I've had the argument that we have to have convictions in order to prove the gang enhancement, and in contrast to that, I've had the argument that, well, you shouldn't be allowed to introduce convictions because that's too prejudicial. So it's sort of a unique beast in that there's a lot of different arguments that have been made, but the fact of the matter is when you look at the statute and you look at the case law, the way that we've presented it and the amount of information, the credibility that the jury assigns the expert is what counts. There isn't a single requirement that there be convictions. There's not a prohibition that there not be convictions. There isn't a prohibition against juvenile involved. It's a totality of the circumstances of the testimony that's been provided, and I believe that we met that in this case. Unless there's other questions on that issue, if I may address a couple of other points that were brought up by opposing counsel. I wanted to address a few things about the issue that happened during jury selection, and I wanted to correct maybe the timing of what happened. The statements that occurred by co-defendant Elizondo occurred over the lunch break on the very first day of jury selection. We were not close to having picked the jury. We were actually, the judge was still asking the court's questions of the jury panel, and neither side had had an opportunity yet to question the veneer. At the time that happened, it was raised by one of the juror members, and that juror member was quickly cut off so that an inquiry could be made outside the presence of the other jurors. And ultimately, individually, each juror who was actually present outside the courtroom at the time that the conversation took place was brought in to be questioned. Or I should say, at least the first few were brought in, and once the state had an idea, a better idea of what had been said, we conceded that anybody who was out in the hallway and heard that conversation should be excused from the jury. So we didn't actually get to bring each of them in, but once we had some more information, we went ahead and agreed to that. The whole veneer was not outside in the hallway at the time that these conversations was made. It was the lunch break, and many of them had gone to lunch and did not overhear the conversation. After we concluded examining all of the jurors who had actually overheard the conversation, there was a second inquiry as to whether any members of the jury had heard any of those people who heard the conversation discussing the matter. And then there was, I believe, 8 individuals, and each of those were brought in and questioned individually. As we went through the questioning, each of those jurors was decided whether they should be kicked for cause on an individual basis. Many of those jurors, I think 4 initially, were kicked for cause during that process. What I want to tell the court, though, is that of those 4, the defense was actually passing for cause on some of them after they had been questioned about that issue. So although they preserved the issue of excluding the whole veneer, they actually did not argue once the questioning had been made of those jurors who had heard about the conversation. They did not move to kick the 4 jurors who then remained in the panel. Of those 4 jurors, ultimately, voir dire progressed. Each side was allowed to take the opportunity to ask questions, and ultimately, 3 of the 4 ended up being kicked for other reasons, not related to this. Kicked for cause, not peremptory challenges. So ultimately, there was only 1 juror who ended up being left on the jury. That juror, the only information that she had heard was that there had been some kind of profanity used. She didn't know which defendant it was, and she, on multiple occasions, from questioning from the court, the state, and defense counsel, said that it would not affect her, that she didn't even know who it was, that it would in absolutely no way affect her ability to sit as a fair juror, and she was never challenged after that point. After she made those statements, there was not a specific challenge to her. I believe that the court in this instance followed the exact process. She made a very detailed and careful consideration of the issue and inquiry into the jurors to make sure that there were no jurors left that had a bias. So I do think that that process was followed appropriately, and there is not grounds for relief there. Moving on to the issue of the supposed inconsistent verdicts. First, I would argue, I think actually the case law covers it pretty well, but I would like to make the point that we can inquire, of course, into the juror's mindset, but you can see that these verdicts are not necessarily inconsistent. There was an additional 3rd count of conspiracy to commit murder that all of the defendants in the case were found not guilty of. That, to me, indicates, when you look at the law and you look at the facts of the case, that there was not a consensus among the jurors that these defendants had gotten together and agreed to commit the crime of murder. That leaves the possibility in the analysis that the jury felt that defendant Elizondo and defendant Good, at a minimum, did have the intention to kill. And that's a personal mindset. It's not the gang mindset. And given that they didn't find that there was a group conspiracy, it certainly makes sense that they might have thought, look, defendant Elizondo and defendant Good, they wanted to kill this guy, they intended to kill this guy, but that wasn't what the gang wanted. The gang just wanted to, for lack of better terms, put a beat down on this guy. It wasn't the purpose of the gang to kill this guy, but defendant Elizondo and defendant Good wanted to go above and beyond. That's certainly a possibility for why they didn't return the gang enhancement on the attempt murder, but they did on the battery with use with substantial bodily harm. Furthermore, as far as the deadly weapon is concerned, we have charged multiple items in the alternative as possible deadly weapons. The same thing is true, but it's certainly possible. We didn't have a special verdict that said which deadly weapon. They could have found that the battery with substantial bodily harm with deadly weapon was conducted with a different instrument than they felt the attempt murder was conducted with. But nonetheless, you don't even have to get into that. I just wanted to make the point that there is an argument to be made that these are not inconsistent. But the United States Supreme Court case of U.S. v. Powell is very direct and on point as to this issue, that this is not inconsistent verdicts are not a basis for reversal, and it's for a lot of the reasons that Justice Pickering mentioned, which is that, for one thing, it could be considered to be favorable to the defendant. If we were allowed to attack inconsistent verdicts, I, as the state, could come in and say, hey, they found beyond a reasonable doubt a deadly weapon and a gang enhancement. That should just automatically tag on to the attempt murder. But that's not how we conduct trials. The state would not be allowed to do that, wouldn't seek to do that, because the jurors are instructed that each count is to be considered individually and separately. So if anything, it's evidence that the jurors did follow the instructions because they did consider each count separately and individually. But I think that there's controlling case law on the matter. I think that the rationale and the persuasive reasoning of Powell certainly apply in this instance, and that, therefore, it's not a basis to reverse the convictions. The last thing, I just have a brief period of time, is just on the motion to sever, I would simply point out that these defenses were not antagonistic defenses. Defendant Gibbs' defense was that he was not present. Defendant Elizondo's defense was a minimization, that he didn't commit the actual crimes that occurred. And they weren't mutually exclusive. The jury could certainly believe that Appellant Good was not present at the time of the crime, and also believe that Appellant Elizondo did not commit the crimes as they were charged by the state. So they weren't mutually exclusive. We did include in the record the redactions that were made to the statement. The redactions resolved any Bruton problems, and therefore I believe that the court appropriately denied the motion to sever. It was all of the same witnesses, as well as one of the points was that, well, there was more evidence that defendant Elizondo was involved in the gang. Well, I disagree that there was more evidence. I would also point out that we would have introduced that evidence at a severed trial anyway, just as we introduced evidence of co-defendant Alexis Tovar and David Sanders' gang involvement, even though they weren't part of the trial proceeding, because that's still evidence of the gang enhancement. So I believe that the denial of the severance was appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to thank both counsel for their excellent briefs and argument. We really appreciate it. This case will be submitted.